They came from across America. The Endless Talker, the Horror Host, the Southern Sensation,
the Comic Book Clergyman.
They meet here in the basement of an abandoned comic book shop for one purpose and one purpose only: to drink from the water cooler of stories and talk about comic books. This is Tales from the Water Cooler.
Welcome, everybody, to the next episode, number 37 of Tales from the Water Cooler. While it sounds like someone's farting in my ear.
That was me.
That?
That was okay. Me.
That's the official way to start the show.
It is. We've started 37 in a row.
37.
Wow.
We're getting up there.
We are.
In a row?
37 weeks.
Never mind. Who do we have this week?
Got Infinite Speech.
Oh, the comic book clergyman.
He forgot his own name.
I did.
And Decapitated Dan. I was in there this week.
He's here in spirit.
He is, man. I wonder what he's doing.
He can never say, because what happens there stays there.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yes.
Very nice.
Secret.
It is
so
secret.
Aside from being very jealous of the man on vacation, I'm doing well.
Yeah. Anybody doing anything fun for Halloween this weekend?
Going to work.
Ooh, that's scary.
reading comic books.
Depending on what you read, that's scary too.
Oh, also going to the... Well, no. Going to work. Halloween is on what? Monday?
Monday.
Okay, yeah. For some reason, I thought it was on Sunday. I'm doing something fun on Sunday, though, but...
Yeah?
Yeah, I'm doing another convention, going to the Albany Comic Con on Sunday.
Nice.
Why
That's
do I
how
have
I do
a
it.
Picture of Joe Jonas?
Because we were talking earlier before the show about the R&B guy Joe singing the national anthem, and Speech talked about how he bore a slight resemblance to Joe.
Grudgingly.
Right. And and so I said, this Joe, and I sent that picture. So that's why you have that.
Oh. Yeah, I see the resemblance. Not.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. I think we have a question this week. It's a doozy.
It is.
It comes from Rafael Nieves, who we've featured on the show with the Apocalypse Plan. I'd like to know who you all think are the top 10 most influential comic creators of the last 10 years.
If I didn't like him, I'd actually refuse to answer the question.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't think there are any?
My opinion, and I've been asked this before, I mean, people have their need to categorize and list shit, but... I just think that my answer is too simplified to appease people. So
deep.
Yeah.
Well, I'm excited. I'm excited to hear it.
Deep. This is a deep question. I mean, we could dedicate a whole show to it, but
yeah, I mean, we actually could. I mean, honestly, I mean, just to give you guys just my honest feeling about it, is that any writer that's doing anything now, you know, as I stated to you guys before, they're pretty much just building on what others have built before, which nothing is wrong with that. I mean, you have a lot of people who have influenced these guys over the decades. My thing is, a lot of people aren't doing anything that new and influential except a lot of the indie guys.
Well, you know, when I was thinking about it, I was thinking about how if you had asked me probably about 10 years ago, I would have come up with maybe some artists on my list.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And this time, like, most of my list are writers. And I really think that while there's not I couldn't think of a lot of influential artists that are like original, you know? I mean, most of them are ones that are doing stuff that others have done before. I mean, they still do it well, but I do think that there are some writers, even mainstream ones, who are doing some things that you know.
We seem to be in the era of the writer now, and
yeah.
The artist out there today back in the 90s.
Right. Right. So, and some of the writers that I chose are also standing on the shoulders of writers who came before, but you know, I think you have to look at kind of comics history and what's going on. What are the big mover and shaker things going on right now? And so, you know, I have a lot of writers on mine, so.
And it's just not right now, it's the last 10 years, so back to 2001.
Right.
So, who wants to kick it off?
I'll go.
Okay.
I am going to say Brian K. Vaughan is my number one. Writer of lots of things in the last 10 years. Why the Last Man, Runaways, and Dan and I have talked about Runaways on this show before, but Runaways is the most original thing that's come out of Marvel, like original characters, original story that's come out of Marvel in the last, I'd say, 20 years. And in fact, it was so well done that really no one has been able to replicate it. I think it's canceled now, mainly just because they don't have anybody good enough to write it. And I mean, seriously, but yeah, I mean, and you know, so I think his work across, Vaughn was not just a Marvel guy. I mean, he was a Vertigo guy with Why the Last Man. He was an Image guy with Ex Machina. You know, he was never shoehorned into one company, even though he did work for, all the major ones. And so, I think the work that he did is pretty influential. I mean, I think we'll look back like at Why the Last Man and be like, now that is how a sci-fi, I guess sci-fi if you want to call it that, kind of book, you know, should be done. So I give it up for BKV.
Yeah, I'll give you that because I remember you guys raving about Runaways, and I went ahead and picked up the hardcover for the first volume, and I was just blown away. So yeah, I give you that.
Yeah,
the originality of it all and the whole story and the premise was like, that was dope, because I was like, okay, I haven't read this before. I mean, I've seen stuff like it, but the story just flows so naturally. It was great.
Yeah. And his upcoming book called Saga, I'm very excited about. So.
Right on. I had a list. I didn't really have them in any kind of order, but I guess I could throw up a number one would be Brian Michael Bendis.
Yeah, he was on my list.
There's not really much you could say, because everybody knows who he is and what he's done and his style. More of a dialogue-heavy, popcorn dialogue, as you would. Boom, boom, boom. But, he's had a lot of influence on the way comics have been in the last 10 years, mainly because he's written about 80% of them.
Between him and Johns, they write like everything.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, honestly, if it wasn't for Bendis, the Avengers would not be the flagship book that it is at Marvel.
Well, the funny thing is, like, the regular Avengers title, I can't stand.
Right.
New Avengers, I love it. You know, it's just, you know, it's all about, I guess, I don't know if it's just the group that he has there, but I think I stopped collecting that series after like the second issue.
Yeah.
But his work on Scarlet blew me away. New Avengers is like consistently an excellent title.
New Avengers is especially good because I was featured in the first issue of the relaunch.
That's right. You were in there, weren't you?
Were you?
Yep.
Yeah. He's in there. He's an Avenger.
Oh, yeah. Cool. Nice. Well, Speech, how about you?
Let's see. I will actually, I mean, the name I just mentioned, I'll go ahead and say John's, because, and I say that as a personal thing, because the GL titles were ones that I totally despised and did not read back in the day. And he actually had me reading it and enjoying some very rich stories, especially with the Sinestro Corps War. And, you know, for the subsequent years after that, I was blown away and amazed at what this guy was doing with characters I despised and hated, which I always tip my hat off to a writer who can have me enjoy characters that I hated and had no interest in at all whatsoever. So I give him props on making me a fan of that title for a while.
Yeah, he was on my list too. He pretty much single-handedly made DC cool again.
Yeah.
With, you know, Justice Society, Justice League, Green Lantern, Flash.
Yeah.
And that was one title I didn't give a shot, was the Flash one, because he was just, he was one of those characters I couldn't take a whole lot of.
Yeah. And all the event books that he did too. Or, yeah. Because didn't he do all of them? Blackest Night?
Well, no. I mean,
He did Flashpoint, Blackest Night.
Yeah, but they gave Morrison Crisis crap.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right.
Huh. Rangers are on the board. First inning. Boom.
You're going to lose Jeff. You talk about sports, you're going to lose Jeff.
None of that.
This is a special occasion. They could be world champions tonight, so I'm not going to listen to Jeff.
I did fast forward the show last week. Well, my next one, I am going to throw an artist on there. I do have another one, a couple other ones on there on my list. But I'm going to give it up for Scotty Young as an influential artist. I think his work is about as original as I have seen any art. I mean, it's got a cartoony style, but it's very sketchy. It's very dynamic. I love it. I mean, if you told me 10 years ago that I would be reading the Wizard of Oz books on a regular basis, I would have laughed in your face and punched you in the neck. But because of Scotty Young, I just love his art. I mean, I think he's just one of the most dynamic artists in the last 10 years. So, and his stuff on New X-Men was phenomenal, and I've really enjoyed watching him, and to see him kind of commit to a project like the Oz books, that's not one of the top tier books. At all, but he's committed to it, and he's doing it, and he's getting lots of respect for it. He's winning Eisners for it, I just think that's pretty cool stuff.
That's the only title that he's on is the Oz books
right now. Yeah. He does some covers here and there, but pretty much
he's done some X-Men too, hasn't he?
Yeah, he did New X-Men. But that might be it.
So. I'll go with another artist would be Joe Quesada. I mean, agree with some of the decisions he's done or not, he's basically turned Marvel around from their bankruptcy days to what they are now. He's made some bad decisions, but still overall he had that influence over Marvel, which started when Marvel Knights first started. He was running that and was really successful with that, and they gave him the whole boat. So, right. And he's a good artist.
Yep.
He just doesn't draw anymore.
Well, what's interesting is I don't know if I would classify him as a... While I agree with you about his role in the comics world and his role as editor-in-chief of Marvel, I don't think I would qualify him as an influential creator, because his art is not... I don't know. It's not really his art that he's going to be known for. It's going to be his role as editor in chief.
You mean the fans still aren't begging for Ninjak? Because I am.
Yeah.
Damn it! If he was on another Ninjak book, I would buy it.
Right.
Let's see. I actually was throwing an artist up next, and like, as you guys know, I hate butchering names, but it's Saint Japan Cedric, guy that draws Witchblade with Mars, and he's a painter, and I'll always love painted work. Painted work, when done great, is awesome. But the fact he does this on a monthly basis, which means that he is probably drawing fast as hell and still producing the consistent quality of work for this title, and not just the interiors. He's doing those covers. He's doing covers for several other companies as well, but still putting out his own book. Well, not his book, but the book that he's on monthly with Top Cow on a consistent level. And I don't see anybody else painting like that for this long, for this amount of time, on a regular series, not a limited series, not a one shot. This guy's been doing it consistently for quite some time.
And I think the only time, right?
Huh?
It's the deadlines too, right?
Yeah, and I think the only times that they had deadline issues, I mean, it was for, you know, he had personal reasons, because, you know, these people have families and stuff too. So I think he got sick or something. It was like reported a while back and fans were complaining. And they were like, look, man, the guy's sick.
Well, and anybody who throws a J in the middle of their first name is... it's got the thumbs up for me.
I mean, just the amount... I know it takes a lot to just pencil and ink stuff and get that done on time. I mean, this guy here is painting it as well. And the stuff just looks fabulous every single time. So, you know, he'll be on my list.
Wow, yeah. That's a good one. Is it me again?
Yeah.
I'm going to branch out a little bit from my other picks from the kind of the from the Marvel or the top three, and I'm going to go with David Mazzucchelli, and really mainly for his work on Asterius Polyp, who you guys haven't read that. It's to me, I just have never seen a book so well thought out, and using using art as a way, using sequential art in such a way that no other media could tell the story of Asterius Polyp. You know, I've just never seen that done. I mean, you can translate, you know, any superhero book, really, you can translate to film or TV or whatever. But Asterius Polyp used this, used sequential art in a way that, you know, only that art could tell that story. And so I just think it's a really important book, I think, for the overarching decade. And so that's who I pick. Have y'all read that?
No,
I haven't read it.
No.
Should pick it up.
Okay.
It's probably not your usual kind of stuff. I mean, but it's good. I loved it.
Is it better than All Nighter?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Which, by the way, did y'all happen to read the last issue of the All Nighter? Aaron, did you read that?
I did.
Yeah.
I did.
I'm sorry, I missed out.
Yeah.
I was busy.
No, you didn't miss out. I have to say. Anyway, sorry.
Another pick I would have would probably be Steve Niles, who pretty much,
yeah,
with 30 Days of Night, made horror comics cool again. And they weren't just the generic anthologies and stuff here and there, but actual ongoings and stuff that had staying power. So Steve Niles, plus he's an independent as well, so yeah, he's on my list.
That's a good pick. I hadn't thought of him.
You thief, you stole mine.
Dang.
Niles was on my list, though a little bit further down. But I think that was the 10th one, right?
No, that's number 8.
8. Oh my gosh, I am not the counter today. Let me see. I will go ahead and throw in, probably much to many people's displeasure, I'll go ahead and throw in Kirkman.
I agree with that.
I agree with that too.
Yeah, because regardless of what anybody thinks, The Walking Dead has been kicking ass since 2004. And it is now 2011, and we have a TV series, and they just got signed on for, a third season, and the books are still flying off the shelves, even though they've had their dull points at time, as all series do when they run for this long. But, still, you still get great stories, and those, oh my God, what the hell moments that pop up in the books. So, yeah, I'll give it to Kirkman.
Well, and as much as Dan might disagree with this, Robert Kirkman put zombies on the map on a larger scale than any other creator before him.
And he made them mainstream.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, he really he put them on a stage. The fact that I'm reading a zombie book is a testament to that. So.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
and he would argue that he's standing on the shoulders of Gary Reed, which,
yeah,
it could be right, but somebody had to. Kirkman made the. Not too many people have heard of Gary Reed in Dead World, except for who know the indie creators and the indie scene. But as far as the guy next door, you go knock on the door, have you heard The Walking Dead? Yeah, man, that's cool.
That's right.
Well, we can all just agree that mainly everybody's standing on the shoulders of Romero. So,
Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah.
And they're all standing on the shoulders of Stan Lee.
That's right.
Stan's got some pretty big shoulders.
That's a tall stack of people.
There it is.
Yeah. All right, so I get number 10. Let's see. I'm going to throw it out there. I'm going to say Grant Morrison, and not having read any of his DC stuff, and never will, but his work, I'm really qualifying it for his work on X-Men, and a lot of people disagree with me about this, but he did something actually original with the X-Men that has never been done before, and he took the X-Men in a direction that they had never gone before, and he created characters that were bizarre and weird but have lasting impact. Phantom X is a perfect example. Rick Remender is doing pretty phenomenal things with him on Uncanny X-Force, but Uncanny X-Force would not exist today if it hadn't been for Morrison. So, because Well, for instance, you couldn't do the stuff with the world and the time travel stuff with Deathlok. He couldn't have done all of that if unless it had been kind of set up previously by Morrison. So
yeah.
I think his work is, and Grant Morrison is the guy who killed Jean Grey, and she's remained dead for the longest period of time that she's ever been dead. So I think that's...
I'll send him a Christmas card every year she stays dead. I'm thankful for that.
yeah. And honestly, he made the coolest moment in one of the coolest moments in X-Men history, which is when Zorn was revealed to be Magneto, which got retconned like 10 issues later. But still, that's still one of the coolest moments I've ever known. So in X-Men books. So
I would begrudgingly agree that Morrison has been influential in the last 10 years. I don't like his stuff, except for the X-Men run. Everybody knows that Speech and myself don't like his current DC shenanigans, but...
Except Batman and Robin. I did like his run on Batman and Robin.
Yeah, but as far as changing the shape of things...
Yeah.
His psycho babble on drugs.
Well, all that good stuff.
Yep. That's our collective 10. I still got a few more. I'll just rattle them off.
Yeah, go for it.
We'll just throw them out there without discussion unless it pulls up. Kevin Smith.
Oh, yeah.
Garth Ennis. I think Marvel Max was pretty much made for him.
Mm.
J. Michael Straczynski.
Ugh.
Artist Michael Turner. And Gail Simone, who's a woman been writing comics and writing good comics for a very long time.
Cool.
And Rafael Nieves for inspiring us and influencing us to make this list. So,
yeah. How about you, Speech? You got any honorable mentions?
I'm good.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'm good.
Okay. I'm going to throw out Jim Lee. And I'm only basing this on his recent... well, I don't want to talk about it. Anyway, just his the new DC 52 stuff, I think, is influential, and it's going to last. I mean, the ramifications of his stuff is going to last for a while, I think.
But that falls to the same argument that we had for Joe Quesada. He's going to be remembered more as an executive than an artist.
Well, except for the fact that he's actually drawing Justice League.
I don't think that'll be the same thing with Jim, because of Jim's impact on X-Men and all that, and just every and Hush.
90s, that was in the 90s, Hush. Yeah.
Well, yeah, but I mean, if we just, I mean, if it's just Hall encompassing how he'll be remembered, I mean, he's, you know, he's actually putting pen to paper now.
Yeah. Well, and didn't he do a tremendous, I mean, like a lot of the designs for the new characters in the new 52?
Yes.
So that's kind of where I was going with that.
Think those will last? Because he did redesign the other Wonder Woman costume too.
Yeah. Well, that's why I kind of say Jim Lee is. He's kind of a. It's a little too soon to tell, but I do think his work in DC has been significant. So, I also want to throw out Mark Miller, or Mark Millar, however you want to say his name. but mainly because of his work on Civil War. At Marvel, and the Ultimate Universe. I mean, his contribution wasn't as much as Bendis, but I do think that he had kind of a lasting impression. And his work on Civil War. I mean, honestly, Civil War has been the best Marvel event in the last 10 to 20 years. So, and then you could argue, you know, stuff like with Kick-Ass and Nemesis and all of his Miller World stuff. I think that's all significant.
And those are all done for good causes too. You know, he'll auction off main characters' names for like children's charities.
Right, right. And then my last one is Darwin Cook.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he's really great, and a lot of the stuff that he's been doing in the last 10 years, I think, has been pretty top-notch stuff. So,
right on.
Anyway.
Any 2 cents speech?
Well, the funny thing is, most of who Jeff had on his list were on mine, and I knew that was going to happen, so that's why I didn't even say anything.
Okay.
That's why I said I'm good.
Right on. Well, with that, let's dive into this week's picks.
Whee!
Splash. First up, we've got Infinite Speech. What did you pick?
I picked Snake Eyes, numero 6.
In English, please! Think about it. If this comic goes to an issue number 12... Never mind. That's boxcars. Forget it. Snake Eyes, number 6. The Cobra Civil War goes pandemic. The madness bug threatens to spread across Africa, which is a continent, and Duke is infected... as well. His only hope is to find Rodrigo Vargas, the creator of the retrovirus, and the cure. And only Snake Eyes can make that happen. Also features the return of a popular character that's going to make Joe fans jump for joy. Come on without, come on within, as the Cobra Civil War roars towards its shocking climax. Writer Chuck Dixon, and artist Alberto Muriel.
Hold on, it really says come on without, come on within.
Yeah, I don't know what that means.
Come on, Quinn the Eskimo.
Yeah.
Quinn the Eskimo?
Yeah, Bob Dylan song.
Yeah, which is, you know what? It's funny you use that word because of that last page in the book.
Yeah.
And he was serious, too.
That's right.
I picked this because for Snake Eyes is just one of those titles that has just been great when Robert Atkins and Dixon were on it in the beginning. Six issues in, the Cobra Civil War is still like one of the best things to happen to the G.I. Joe title in the past, I'd say, almost 20 years. Cobra Commander is dead, and now everybody in Cobra is jockeying for a position to be the new commander. So basically, whoever racks up the highest amount of kills and causes the Joes, basically cripples them the hardest and does a lot of worldwide damage, will get the vote and they'll be in power. So we have this virus that's running rampant through Africa, and Snake Eyes has chosen this guy named, I think it was Light Horse and Duke, to go on this mission. The problem is in the regular G.I. Joe run, Duke was poisoned. So they've brought that over here. So you got the guys, you know, they had to annihilate an entire village of infected while Snake Eyes and his team, you know, tried to locate Vargas to get a cure for Duke. And, you know, these guys are playing for keeps. Snake Eyes isn't like throwing smoke bombs. They're actually, you know, they're lighting up troops. They're blowing away rooms of people that are just doing the telecoms. And it's just one great issue. And there's one scene where they're trying to convince Vargas to help them. And of course, he's this pompous, arrogant, rich guy. You know, he's like, he thinks he holds all the cards. So Duke takes his mask off, does a cheek sweep with his finger, and digs finger into his own mouth, and then puts it in Vargas's mouth. And then he basically transfers the virus to him, and then they bag him in like some kind of like airtight seal so he can't infect the rest. And they're basically threatening him and everyone else to get a cure for not only Duke, but for the little village in Africa where this disease is running rampant. But, you know, they infiltrate the house and basically blow it all to hell trying to get through. And then they meet up with this mystery Inuit guy who dares, I think it was Light Horse or whatnot, that if he called him an Eskimo, he'd like do something to his face where he slices his face up or carve him into a kayak or something.
Yeah.
It was just great. Yeah, he said, don't call me an Eskimo. But, I'll let you guys have it.
Is he the G.I. Joe that fans would stand up and jump for joy for?
Who?
The Eskimo.
Quinn.
Oh. Don't call him an Eskimo. He'll carve a kayak out of you.
Whose turn is it?
My turn. But I didn't really get the part of this list, that the return of a popular Joe character. Was that the Eskimo dude?
I guess so.
I don't remember a popular character returning, but oh well.
Yeah, I don't either.
This issue was pretty cool. It was pretty basic, I thought. You know, he had a plan. You get in, get out. Stick to the mission. They had a little monkey wrench throwing the plans when what they were looking for wasn't where they were at. But I've kind of fallen off the Civil War wagon here, but it was a good story, and it's no, I wouldn't say it's a safe jump on point, really, but since we've had experience before, it's cool here now, and the cover was cool, and the cover for next issue is cool. Snake Eyes covers are just cool. They can just have Snake Eyes pinups, and I would buy them.
I think every single cover has been just Snake Eyes.
Yep. Yeah.
Unless, I know, like some retailer incentive covers that Atkins did one. It's got like a dead helix and Snake Eyes just shooting up a bunch of Cobra troops. But like, yeah, every single cover has just been awesome.
That's what I got. Plain and simple issue this time around. Nothing complex or hard to follow. Get in, get out, boom. A little move the story over. wasn't any Grant Morrison complex where I had to go to a blog to figure out what the hell Snake Eyes is doing.
All right, Jeff.
All right. There are a couple things that I just kind of wish, I think, that could have made this one better. I thought this was good, and the fact that it was kind of in the middle of the story, it was pretty safe. I mean, I knowing G.I. Joe history and stuff, it was easy to kind of know who the characters were and that kind of thing. Although, I didn't know that that was Duke until about halfway in, and I kept thinking, who is this guy? Like, who is Snake Eyes' partner? Because I don't know, I haven't been keeping up with the story. So it wasn't until, like, I guess they get picked up by Lighthouse, or Light Horse. Was that his name? Light Horse? Or Lighthouse?
Yeah, I think it's Light Horse.
Anyway, that I think he calls him Duke, and I was like, oh, finally, okay, that's who that is. So,
yeah, I didn't know who he was either until they said that.
Hold on. Quick question. You guys don't read the inside cover, like the recap section?
I mean,
you just dive on into the book, huh?
Yeah.
I only read those when Deadpool does it.
Got you.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, well, there was a bit of a recap section.
Okay. Anyway, but I thought the story was, I mean, even with that, I mean, the story was still easy to follow. I mean, it doesn't take an idiot to figure out who's who, and I loved the finger swipe and sticking it in the guy's mouth, and I thought that was really cool. Not really knowing all the larger things that are going on in this story, this was a good kind of singular mission, I'm sure it has a great deal to do with other things that are going on in this story widespread, but the art was pretty basic. I mean, there wasn't anything really bad about it. The only thing that just kind of annoyed me was, I guess Snake Eyes doesn't, like, I guess he doesn't tuck in his pants into his boots anymore.
Yeah, those pants got on my nerves.
Yeah, they did.
He's not
full
like a ninja.
Yeah, I know. He's not aerodynamic with his pants all hanging out. He kind of looks slobby. I was like...
Like a dork.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
He's got the flare jeans at the bottom.
He did. It was like bootcut jeans he's wearing, and I'm like, I thought that was a little weird, but especially because, you know, the top of him is very skin tight, and you know, and he's got all the grenades strapped to him and all this stuff, and then he's wearing kind of these huge knee pads and this. These pants that aren't, I don't know. So I thought that was a little weird for, you know, Snake Eyes to
be
wearing. Must
be laundry day.
Well, the pit was destroyed, so I guess he's pretty much stuck wearing what he has.
Yeah, yeah.
He needs to get with a Scarlet and make sure it doesn't happen to you.
And my only thing about the art is that Atkins nor Padilla are drawing it for right now. And those are like two of my favorites on this title, and I haven't seen Atkins since the first arc wrapped up, except on covers.
Is that what we read
a while back?
A while back,
it was issue 3.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. That guy.
Yeah, he was good. He was better than this. But anyway, it was still a pretty decent book here. So, yeah, that's all I got to say.
Let's go ahead and rate this puppy.
I'd give Snake Eyes number 6, 7.5.
I give it a 6.5.
I, too, will give it a 6.5.
And a half?
Yeah. And 3/4. I mean, what do you want?
Right on. We'll go to the next pick, which was my pick. I picked Batman number 2. Batman hunts a new and deadly killer in Gotham City. A killer with a vendetta against Bruce Wayne. But who is the mysterious killer in an owl skull mask, and is he the key to unlocking one of Gotham's oldest and most terrifying secrets? By writer Scott Snyder and drawn by Greg Capullo. Capullo. I don't know how to say his name. We'll go with
Capullo.
Capullo. All right. I picked this book for... one specific reason. It's because Jeff said he read number 1 and he was not going to be reading number 2. And it came out, he was going to be on this week, so I picked it. And because we've all read number 1, we're safe with this number 2.
So hold on, you just saw that it was coming out and said, I'm picking it because Jeff said he would not read the second issue.
He's a spiteful man.
Was my main reason, yes, and everything else was kind of this week. But yeah, we find out that the cliffhanger from issue number 1 was pretty much just swept under the rug, no big deal. He's character in question is safe to go and do his thing, and we just got Batman action riding motorcycles, following helicopters. It's cool stuff. Nothing really groundbreaking. Shut up. That just makes you a liar. So yeah, there's nothing spectacular or exciting about this Batman. It's just a good Batman story. I like Batman. Everybody likes Batman. You go knock on your neighbor's door, he's going to say, yeah, I like Batman too. So we're okay with it. There's nothing really... This kind of differs from Snyder's run on Detective Comics when it was more dark and macabre. I don't see those same elements here. It's just some more fun Batman stuff going on. So go ahead, Jeff.
Well, what we were laughing about just a minute ago was I actually did lie, and I did actually read this before Aaron even picked it. So, just because I wanted to give it another shot, and I'm glad I did. I have to say this issue was a lot better than the first issue. My main issue with the first one was Capullo's art. Really, I was really expecting, because I was a big fan of his. When he first started on Spawn, and when he did X-Force back in the day, like, I loved his stuff way back then, and so I was really looking forward to that, and the fact that, you know, Scott Snyder and he were, I mean, I thought that's a pretty good team, and here it is on the first issue of Batman. You know, if you know, there's not many creators that will pull me into a DC book, honestly, but these guys made me at least interested in it, and that's why I picked it up. But but my main issue with the first one was the size differential between Bruce, who's like 40 feet tall, and Dick, who was like 3 feet tall, and you know, and I just thought, okay, I just that kind of just annoyed me. It was things like that, but the story didn't really grab me. I mean, it wasn't like, ooh, yes, I have to keep going. But this part. Did this part actually drew me in a little bit more. I really liked the mystery that's surrounding this what are they called, the owls, the Court of Owls or whatever they're called.
Yeah.
I liked that. I loved the that scene where the guys are on the train and Batman rides up on the bat cycle next to him and just yanks the guy out of the window. Like, that's classic Batman stuff right there, man. It's just good. And then he, you know, then he, and I don't know how he does this, but I mean, it's Batman, you know, he like hops up on top from, you know, he's like chasing him. And then all of a sudden, not only can he like, you know, chase a train that's going at high speeds, but like he can also just jump right on top of it. And so he gets on top and this helicopter's coming towards him and he plays chicken with them, and it's just awesome. And all the while, he's having a conversation with Alfred. It's just classic Batman stuff, and it's stuff that I think is really good. I thought Capullo did a much better job on this issue, mainly because, you know, there's not a lot of just straight up Batman or Bruce and Dick standing next to each other. And then I liked that the story was kind of framed by this fall out of Wayne Tower and all this, and the mystery surrounding this politician that Bruce is talking with. You know, there's something going on with him too. So, anyway, I thought this was a great issue, and I, you know, so there, Aaron.
All right.
I did.
I think I did.
That's what it sounds like. Goodness. He actually, you know, had a good time reading it. All right. Batman number 2. I will say that I like this one better than the first issue, though. It was kind of abrupt when you get a cliffhanger like you did in the first issue, and then to come to this, and, you know, you have the opening scene here with Bruce being knocked out of the window. And then, you know, we switch over to what happened a little bit before that. That was great. I love Capullo's shot from the inside of the guy's body up to Gordon and the coroner as they're in there. That was a perfect angle, just art-wise. That was just a great way to tell the story right there, because it just gives you, I mean, it just makes it a little bit more disgusting than what that scene was supposed to be, and that was great. And then, you know, you have Batman introducing his new little gadgets in the morgue, how he can just scan the body there. So you can just do it, do everything from the comfort of the cave. We have a little guest appearance from Dick, which was okay. And I like their banter back and forth. It just seems like, you know, that hasn't changed among, you know, all the other smaller details that have with the new 52. But all in all, the story was great up until the end, which just seemed stupid.
Really?
You got this guy. Yeah, okay, you got the guy, right? The bad guy falls. He crashes through the car. You are telling me that between the EMTs, the cops, and the fire department, nobody's going to fucking pull his mask off? They're just going to put the sheet over his head?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, they just put the sheet over his head. I mean, that part was so... That was just stupid. And then his eyes light up underneath the sheet, and, you know, he wakes up. But I'm like, that whole part just seemed like a cheesy, cheap way out. I would have rather a different sequence be written for him to escape that would have been a lot more believable than him falling and he's surrounded by all these law guys and nobody pulls off his mask. Because that would have been the first thing that would have happened. His mask would have come off because they would have tried to see if they could have, you know, see any damage, see if they could save him, see who he is. But nope. Just going to cover him up with a sheet, toss him in the back of an ambulance, and see what happens. Yeah, not very smart writing on that part. So,
well, it's Gotham City, you know, and they're used to picking up dead costume crazy, so probably just no thing.
Nah, as much as they probably used to it, believe me, masks are peeled back. Humans are, we're nosy.
They might have thought that was his face.
No, I'm sorry. His mask was not that tight. By nature, we are nosy ass creatures, and we would want to know who was under the mask.
Yeah.
So yeah, that part, like the book was actually great up until that part. It was like kind of like the ending on the first issue, kind of just dropped me, and this one did the same thing. So at least that's consistent. Both the endings and both the issues sucked so far. While the bulk of the story was pretty good. So I'll leave it at that. I think the artwork is great, Jeff. I don't understand what your thing was.
I liked it here. The first issue, it just didn't hit me.
Well, I kind of can see what his argument, though. Capullo, yeah, when he was drawing Spawn, I loved it. Todd ain't drawing it. I'm glad this guy is. He's great. But this doesn't even look like the same kind of art to me. And the teaser that they'd been using for Batman number one, which was the cover, looked nothing like, it was the same picture, but it looked nothing like the cover that they actually used. It looked totally different to me. Batman looked kind of like fat and dumpy. But this doesn't, it's like his style has evolved a little bit since the Spawn days, and it's not the same.
Well, and honestly, I mean, his style when he first started on Spawn was a complete ape of Todd McFarlane. I mean, he was trying to be as consistent with McFarlane's style as he could be. So, you know, I do think this does remind me a little bit more of his work pre-Spawn, which I actually liked better. But yeah, I thought this issue was a lot better. So.
Oh, and question: where the hell was the Owl pulling all those daggers from? Because I saw like all the stilettos and the daggers on his chest and wrist, and he kept pulling them out, but he had the exact same number on his chest and wrist throughout the entire story.
You don't want to know where he pulled them out of.
I'm sitting there like, hold on, there's still like six or seven across his chest. I'm like, and then, you know, they left him with his weapons too. I mean, it's just, the end just threw it for me. I'm sorry.
Maybe the people who picked him up are working for him.
No, that couldn't be the case. You saw all the blood on the last page.
Well, sometimes the Joker kills his employees, too.
No, this guy's an assassin. He rolls solo.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and rate. I give this one a 6.5 as well.
I'll give it a 7.5.
I give it a 7, too.
All right.
That damn ending.
Our last pick, which would be
Uncanny X-Men number 544.
Eulogy. After the hammer blow of fear itself and the violence of schism, it can't go on. It's the end of the Uncanny X-Men. And who better to provide a stirring eulogy than Mr. Sinister? Join us for the end of the industry-shaping series with the return of the 19th century's finest morally dubious scientist. Written by Kieran Gillen, pencils and cover by Greg Land.
Well, now, you guys talked a lot about this issue already last week, but I wanted to put in my two cents. And my two cents is this. A potentially fantastic idea that is totally and utterly just done completely wrong. I thought for a final issue, this had so much potential. Let me just say, first of all, is in terms of final issue, this is not the final issue. I mean, next issue will be number one, but as far as I'm concerned, it's number 545. And that's actually what I'm going to start calling it that, because nothing is going to really change. This is just another one of Marvel's ploys. Honestly, here with making this my pick, I'm really pulling a Billy here and picking something just to rip it apart. I really liked that there was kind of this story of Mr. Sinister, and he's really kind of cataloging the history of the X-Men, and he kind of keeps tabs of their history, and I really liked that idea, and on paper I think it worked. I especially liked his big dry erase board with all of the, I guess it's a dry erase board, but the board with all of the family trees on it, and him kind of keeping tabs of everything, and I liked the use of the first page of X-Men number one, but changing the dialogue to be kind of the, you know, what's going on currently in the X-Men. But beyond that, everything else in this story is just complete garbage. Scott Summers, why should I even care about Scott Summers? He is the biggest ass. Yes. I know he's dark and brooding, and he does that, but like, he's just such an ass. And even though he had the better stance, I think in the conflict between he and Logan, I mean, he had the better argument, but still, I don't like him. I mean, I just think he's dumb and stupid, and then just him kind of, saying, "Oh, I feel like I finally graduated," and it's just like, "Oh, come on, you're a traitor. You're basically just a traitor." And so I thought that was weird. I thought Beast coming just to rub it in Scott's face was weird. Honestly, the only person who I thought actually kind of stood out was Iceman, which I'm glad he's getting the spotlight a little bit. But he kind of names all the things that I was feeling, which is, Scott, you're kind of a jerk, and you're no fun anymore. And so anyway, I mean, all of that. And I liked Sinister's role in this book, but, there again, I just feel like it was just kind of poorly done in the end. And there again, you always have Greg Land's art, who just, please let it end. Please Let it end. Let him go do any other book at Marvel, please. You know, like, let him work on the Avengers. Let him work on anything. Why this? Why?
I love your Greg Land rants, man. I love this.
Why does everybody have to look like a grinning idiot? Like, it's just so dumb. Anyway, so
Cyclops didn't grin the whole issue.
No, he didn't. But you're right. But now I will say, I don't know if you guys picked up any books today, but if you haven't, you should go read Wolverine and the X-Men #1. I really liked it. So anyway, but you can read about it on the X-Piles on comicattack.net. So anyway, so with that rant, I'm going to be done and pass it on.
How can you follow that?
Yeah, I mean. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Should we even try, Aaron?
I mean, y'all kind of covered it a little bit last week, so if you want to just move on to backup picks, it's fine with me.
No, I mean, I'll go.
Okay.
I'll go. Well, first I want to hit on the Beast part. I don't think Beast came to just rub it in to Scott.
You don't?
However, him and Scott have had unresolved issues back when Beast got captured and was tortured for like a month. And, you know, he brought that to Scott's attention, and that's something Beast has never been able to get over, which he probably shouldn't. And Scott's attitude is like, Hank, get over it. But Hank was right. You know, Scott, you weren't the one in the torture chamber, so don't get all self-righteous. So, and I mean, overall, the interesting parts of the book were the entire sequences with Mr. Sinister, though I don't understand the killing himself and bringing himself back. First, I thought it was he didn't like something in himself, or, you know, and then he liquefied himself and got pooped out the machine and came back naked and soaked. But, you know, that's neither here nor there. Overall, this is the kind of issue I expected it to be. Scott being a hard ass, everybody, you know, doing the final split, and like any breakup, he's getting rid of like all the pictures and shit. I knew that was going to happen, and it was going to be, you know, semi-deep. And you're right about the artwork. Greg Land's artwork, though, in this one, I do think it was a tad bit better than some of the other stuff I've seen. And we get that one collage shot of, like, X-Men through the years. We even get a little shot of Pete, Nightcrawler, and Wolverine at baseball time. But, you know, like I said, it was nothing that was unexpected. However, it was nothing that I necessarily see that was needed. I mean, they've been hyping this up as the final issue. I think it could have it deserved more.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It deserved a lot more than
that's where they, it's not really a final issue. So they
yeah, I mean, I understand that. I understand that probably in 2 or 3 years they're going to pick up with the numbering and everything, but don't hype it up, you know, as the quote unquote final Uncanny X-Men issue. And then you give us something this par for $4.
Right.
This was not worth it at all. I mean, give me some, you know, give me hell a cover gallery.
Yeah.
something else, you know, a little bit more detail, a little bit more story. This was not great in any sense of the word. I mean, I liked Regenesis better than this. And yeah. I didn't like that one.
Yeah.
But,
yeah,
you know, books like this are a waste of time because it did. What did it move? What did it do?
Well, it set up Sinister.
No, this could have been done in a couple pages of the first issue.
Yeah, yeah.
This moved the plot nowhere.
Oh, and the fact that, you know, and I think y'all mentioned this last week about how this is happening at the same time as, you know, Regenesis. You know, like, there's a scene where Bobby's getting on the plane to go with Logan in Regenesis, but then here he's talking, and yeah, you know, I just was like,
he's the last one left.
Yeah, why?
Yeah, he's the last one to leave.
And And his reason for being in the danger room, so stupid. That was stupid.
Well, he's hanging out. You know, he's getting that last run. Got to stay frosty.
Yes, stay frosty.
And when did he go back to wearing the old school boots?
I think that was just a retro.
An homage?
Yeah.
And yeah,
he got his
closet
and he left.
He found them. He said, hey, I haven't worn these in old years. Yeah, but yeah, this issue was a complete letdown, honestly. It was a complete and utter letdown. Like I said, it didn't move anything forward. The parts with Sinister could have been done in a couple pages in the first issue. And, you know, ripped off. $4. I could have bought something else for $4.
Right. Right.
Yeah, I'll hand it over to Aaron.
Okay. I agree with Jeff. They're setting it up for a bigger deal as far as numbering. Just look at the ad in this thing for Fantastic Four number 600.
Exactly.
We're changing it to FF now, and it's the Future Foundation. Well, it's going to go back. See, people were saying it. It happened. This thing's going to go back to original numbering within a year or whenever they're ready for 600 as well. But I don't call this one number Uncanny X-Men number 544. I call this Schism 5.1. Because, you know, in Schism, Bobby got on the plane. And in here, he hasn't gotten on the plane yet. And I'm told that that happened in Regenesis, and it's just rehashing the old stuff. It's just, I don't know, it's stupid. And why bring in Sinister? It seems like every time the X-Men have a transition, Sinister's there. Was he just there to say the future is going to be Sinister?
I guess.
That really made no sense to me.
And why say the X-Men are over? They're not over. The X-Men are not over.
There's like 12 X-teams.
Yes! Like, this is not disassembled where they actually destroyed the team and said there are not going to be any more Avengers and then rebuilt the Avengers from there. Like,
yeah. Yeah, there have been multiple X-Men teams throughout the decades. This is nothing new. Yeah, and Marvel's trying to put the fresh coat of paint on it and sell us the same thing. I'm like, yeah, it's under different circumstances why the teams are divided now. But it's still the whole multiple team concept.
Yeah.
You know, the thing is, though, it's a good ideas can be marred by bad just bad ads and just the bad hype and just putting a twist on it that doesn't need to be there. Just forget all the hype. Tell me a good story. Make it worth my money and I'll be happy.
And don't renumber it. There's no need for it.
Yeah. Don't give me a final issue that, first of all, is out of continuity with events that happened a couple of weeks ago in your other title. I'm like, do these guys even like fact check with each other? Okay, is Bobby on the plane in your book? Because I have him already in Westchester.
But it was by the same author.
Exactly. So I'm like, you know, editorial, can we step our game up? You know, when you're going through looking.
So bad.
Terrible.
Can we rate this?
Yes.
I'll give it a 3.
3.
1.
Oh, I was giving it a 3 just because I like the little baseball pick of Logan, Nightcrawler, and Colossus.
I meant to mention that. There was some cool stuff in like the reminiscing scene, but...
Yeah, oh, and Bobby's boots. You brought out the old school boots. I'm surprised he still fits those.
They could have put Zorn in the picture.
I know.
Zorn was
but,
cool.
But he got retconned, though, so, you know.
Yeah. Like, he doesn't even exist now? Well, he's dead.
I don't know. That was just a big mess. That was actually when I dropped X-Men, was when Morrison was writing. So, my apologies.
Over and done with.
Yeah. So is it backup time, guys?
It's backup time.
Back it up!
All right, well, my backup pick will be Red Hood and the Outlaws number 2. aside, I know like the first issue had all the controversy or whatnot, and I went ahead, I was like, well, you know what, I'm gonna give the second issue a shot just in case, and I liked it a lot. I mean, you got Rockefort's art, who is the guy is just awesome. When he was on the Top Cow books, it was great. This issue was great. And Jason Todd is a character that I was liking before the whole New 52 thing, and it's just more of the same here, and he's just that much cooler. And the whole you get introduced to the people that trained him, and it sounds like they're kind of keeping along the lines of his origin when Talia threw him in the Lazarus pit. He came back. You know, all of that still is intact, but it looks like there were some tweaks along the way. And the real Roy and Starfire are basically on their way to the point where the story ends in the first issue. So this is, they kind of go back to go forward in this one, which meant the plot moved, unlike in the last Uncanny X-Men issue where it pretty much was stagnant. But anyway, Rockefort's art, every fight scene was just great. I mean, if this guy was drawing DC books years ago, I would have probably been a bigger fan. But yeah, all in all, Red Hood and the Outlaws 2, much better improvement than the first issue. I think there's just a little bit more substance here. And I mean, I like Lobdell's work anyway. I just, you know, I think the guy did get kind of a bad rap with the first issue.
Did Starfire proposition anybody this time?
No, she didn't proposition anybody, but I mean, it's just the fact that, I mean, a stewardess came on to Jason. I'm pretty sure somebody's going to get mad about that, but I mean, I'm sorry. That kind of stuff happens. You know, but I mean, it wasn't all racy like the first issue, which probably, I don't know, could have been done on purpose. Just to get the word out, just to get the name out, just to cause a bit of controversy, to get the sales up, to get people talking, to get people noticed, whether it's good publicity or bad. Other than that, still great issue, though. So that's my backup.
I had a few good things I could have for backup. I think Justice League number 2 was dope.
Yes, it was.
It was way better than the first issue. But my backup pick is Catwoman number 2. I don't know if y'all are reading Catwoman, but it's a pretty cool series. I've always liked the Catwoman series. You know, comics would be the only time I dropped Catwoman, but there's another series now, and yeah, it's got the boobs and the underwear and Catwoman bumping uglies with Batman, and most of the costumes stayed on. But there's a lot of violence in this issue too, and a little bit of a mystery set up, and I can't remember who's writing it. Maybe it's Lobdell?
No, I think Judd Winnick is writing it.
Yeah, Winnick is writing it. But it's good. You know, I don't think too many people are picking up Catwoman, but it was a surprise. It's probably one of the better series, I think, of the new relaunch.
I actually thought I was the only person not reading it. Like, everybody I know is reading it and picking it up. I don't think I've been a consistent reader of that character since Jim Ballant. Years ago, so.
Did you read the Darwin Cook stuff?
Off and on, just a little bit.
Yeah.
But nothing, like, consistent. I don't know, something about that character, I can, like, tolerate her in spurts and when she pops up, but I don't know, I just have never been interested in a full-on series featuring her. Maybe I'll get the first few issues if they toss them in trade.
Yeah. But it's got sex and violence and intrigue, and it's pretty cool. So that's my backup pick. I guess it would call it a sleeper, but I guess everybody's reading it, so it's new for the water cooler.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. That's two DC books in a row as backup picks.
Well, you just sure as hell know this.
Would Jeff make it a trifecta here?
No, I'm not. No way. My backup pick is X-Factor number 226 by Peter David and Leonard Kirk. I talked about this already on the COC podcast but a little bit, but I want to highlight a couple things that I didn't highlight there. One is David Yarden, who does the covers for X-Factor right now, is just a beautiful, beautiful person, and he is really kicking ass on these covers, and so just check out that cover alone. That's worth the price of admission. But this is just a neat book. Peter David just continues to be consistent and making these characters interesting and fun, and balancing humor and action and drama, and it's just a great X book. And next to Uncanny X-Force, I mean, I'd say X-Factor is probably the best X-Men book out there right now. And it's just consistently good all the time. And in this issue, they fight a guy named the Hangman, who is an old school Marvel villain, and some cool things happen. And
so it's not a new guy with the same old name, or
it's the actual old guy. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And then let's see. Richter jokingly propositions Layla for a threesome with he and Shatterstar, and she actually agrees to it. And he's like, "What? What?"
God.
Yeah. And she says, in reference to Richter, "I bet he makes the Earth move." And Shatterstar says, "You have no idea." So, it just continues to be good quality X-Factor-licious fun.
I remember when Rob Liefeld threw a fit when they made Shatterstar gay.
Yeah. But Shatterstar is cooler than he's ever been in my book, so.
Right on.
Yeah.
So we can move to Stay Away From Things.
Mine is Fearless number one.
Fearless.
Yeah.
What is that?
It's a Cullen Bunn book.
Huh?
It's a Cullen Bunn book, really. It's not good stuff.
I mean, it's not all right. I mean, they're picking up the pieces from Fear itself, which is great. But I mean, it's not just Bunn, it's Bunn, Fraction, and Yost. It's like three people. And
is
the
it an
opening
anthology?
Huh?
Is it an anthology?
No. It's you get one straight story. I mean, it sets up the fact that now that since the hammers are scattered everywhere like the Dragon Balls, now everybody is just on the hunt, and you got Valkyrie now, who's kind of like, she's Captain America wants it to be kept. You know, the problem here, we'll take care of it. She disagrees. She ends up kicking War Machine's ass, or Iron Man 2.0. But it's just like, I'm just like, well, can we let the Fear Itself thing just die? It's just, I'm just like, ugh. Now it's going to be some global, worldwide hunt for all of them, and I don't know. This issue just didn't grab me, and it's 12 issues long. And I'm not looking forward to 12 issues of this.
I know it's going to be more of the same. I know what you can do.
What?
You can not read it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's the only thing.
The preview for it in Fear Itself number 7 really didn't catch my attention, so. And even though I had Colin Bunn's name on it.
There's also quite a few artists in this as well. Well, you get two, but I mean, it's just like, But yeah, the Art Adams cover is great. But I've been a big fan of his work since I was a kid, so. But yeah, wasn't too fond of Fearless number one. It didn't like make me say, hey, I want to buy 11 more of these issues. So yeah, I'll leave it at that. Fearless number one, blah.
My stay away from pick would be IDW's The Dunwich Horror number one.
Ah!
I really wanted this to be good so I could have Jeff read it. Because of things that have transpired in the past, but
my eyes, my eyes.
I think it's a modernization of the story, but number one, I don't think it went anywhere. It was boring, and there's a backup feature, The Hound, also by H.P. Lovecraft, which is my favorite Lovecraft story of all time that I've read. And I was like, okay, I'll check it out, see how they do it in the comic book. but it's just the prose written in some bad cursive handwriting that's hard to read on top of full art pages. It's just stupid. I don't want to reread the short story and strain my eyes to read this ugly cursive, but I'm like,
ah, dang it. This is why Dan produces the show and not the Comic Book Clergyman. Sorry about that, but we got cut off there for some reason, and we lost the end of the show. But anyway, just gonna mention my stay away from pick, which was Fear Itself number 7. Blah blah blah. It sucked. Don't pick it up. We also talked a little bit about All Nighter number 5 and what a letdown that was. But really, the end of the show that you really need to know about is that you can go to comicattack.net and look up all the fantastic stuff that we do on there, everything from the Chirps to the other podcasts, the COC podcast, Discussions with Decapitated Dan, our manga reviews by our good friend Kristen, our fantastic editor Kristen, lots and lots more. Ink Stains, Billy's Ye Old School Cafe, and lots of other things that are just really great. So go check out everything at comicattack.net. And again, sorry about the mistake here at the end, but Dan will be back next week, and you'll have a very smooth recording. So have a good night. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.